Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I finished the last show talking about the systematic bankruptcy of the banks. Now, only a few big banks are considered too big to fail, entitling them to taxpayer bailout. But in some sense, all banks operating on the fractional reserve system are teetering on bankruptcy. Recall the definition of the term bankruptcy: being unable to pay one's debts, being insolvent, having liabilities in excess of a reasonable market value of assets held. In an article called Fractional Reserve Banking, Murray Rothbard put the problem like this, quote, "Depositors think of their checking account as equivalent to a warehouse receipt. If they put a chair in a warehouse before going on a trip, they expect to get the chair back whenever they present the receipt. Unfortunately, while banks depend on the warehouse analogy, the depositors are systematically deluded. Their money isn't there. An honest warehouse makes sure that the goods entrusted to its care are there in its storeroom or vault, but banks operate very differently. Banks make money by literally creating money out of thin air, nowadays exclusively deposits rather than banknotes. This sort of swindling or counterfeiting is dignified by the term fractional reserve banking, which means that bank deposits are backed by only a small fraction of the cash they promise to have at hand and redeem," end quote. Before 1913, if too many of a bank's depositors came for their money at one time, the bank would have come up short and would have had to close its doors. That was true until the Federal Reserve Act shored up the system by allowing troubled banks to borrow money from the Federal Reserve, which could create it on the spot by selling government securities to a select group of banks that created the money as bookkeeping entries on their books. By rights, Rothbard said, the banks should be put into bankruptcy and the bankers should be jailed as embezzlers, just as they would have been before they succeeded in getting laws passed that protected their swindling. Instead, big banks are assured of being bailed out from their folly, encouraging them to take huge risks because they are confident of being rescued if things go amiss. This moral hazard has now been built into the decision-making process. But small businesses don't get bailed out when they make risky decisions that put them underwater. Why should big banks have that luxury? In a free market, big banks should be free to fail like any other business. It would be different if they actually were indispensable to the economy, as they claim, but these global mega banks spend most of their time and resources making profits for themselves at the expense of the small consumer, the small investor, and small countries. There are more efficient ways to get the banking services we need than by continually feeding and maintaining the parasitic banking machine we have now. It may be time to cut the mega banks loose from the Fed's apron strings and let them deal with the free market forces they purport to believe in. Without the collusion of the Plunge Protection Team, the CRMPG, and the Federal Reserve, some major banks could soon wind up in bankruptcy. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, deals with bankrupt banks by putting them into receivership, a form of bankruptcy in which a company can avoid liquidation by reorganizing with the help of a court-appointed trustee. When a bank is put into receivership, the trustee is the FDIC, an agency of the federal government. In return for bailing the bank out, the FDIC has the option of retaining the bank as a public asset. While this might not be a disaster for the larger community that has been predicted, and might even work out to the public's benefit, will be discussed later. What can we do to protect ourselves and our assets in the meantime? Like Auntie M from The Wizard of Oz, market bears warn to run for the cellar. They say to prepare for the coming storm by getting out of U.S. stocks, the U.S. dollar, and excess residential real estate, and to invest instead in gold and silver, precious metal stocks, oil stocks, foreign stocks, and foreign currencies. Many good books and financial newsletters are available on this subject. People in serious doomsday mode, however, go further. They advise storing canned and dry food, drinking water, and organic seeds for sprouting and planting, investing in a water purifier, light source, stove, and heater that don't depend on functioning electrical outlets, keeping extra cash in the family safe for when the banks suddenly close their doors, and storing gold and silver coins for when paper money becomes worthless. They recommend starting a garden in the backyard, a hydroponic garden, plants grown in water, or a window box garden, or joining a local community farming project. They note that people facing financial collapse in other countries are better prepared to deal with that sort of disaster than Americans are because they have been farming their own small gardens and surviving in barter economies for centuries. Americans need to study, form groups, and practice in order to be prepared. Again, many good internet websites are available on this subject. Later on, I'll discuss community currency options. Those are all prudent alternatives in the event of economic collapse, but in the happier ending to our economic fairy tale, the financial system would be salvaged before it collapses, and I'll get back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, we can certainly stock the cellar just in case there is a cyclone, but to succumb to the fear of scarcity is to let the wicked witch prevail, to let the cartel, that's the banking cartel, once again wind up with all of the houses and the stock bargains. What then of the American dream, the liberty and justice for all in a land of equal opportunity, promised by the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution? The irony is that our economic nightmare is built on an illusion. We have been tricked into believing we are inextricably mired in debt when the debt is for an advance of credit that was ours all along. While trouble boils and bubbles in the pots of the witches of Wall Street, the good witch stands waiting in the wings, waiting for us to remember our magic slippers and come into our own power. So now we'll look at the magic slippers, taking back the money power. Just as Glinda the Good Witch said to Dorothy, you had to find it out for yourself. Now those magic slippers will take you home in 2 seconds. So let's step from scarcity into technicolor abundance. Just again, by looking at the Wizard of Oz, a few of the lyrics from the song, somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. One of the most dramatic scenes in the MGM version of The Wizard of Oz comes when Dorothy's cyclone-tossed house falls from the sky. The world transforms as she opens the door and steps from black-and-white bareness of a Kansas farmhouse into the technicolor wonderland of Oz. The world transforms again when Dorothy and her companions don green-colored glasses as they enter the Emerald City. In the wizard's world, reality can be changed just by looking at things differently. Historian David Parker wrote on Baum's fairy tale, quote, the book emphasized an aspect of theosophy that Norman Vincent Peale would later call the power of positive thinking. Theosophy led to a new upbeat and positive psychology that opposed all kinds of negative thinking, especially fear, worry, and anxiety. It was through this positive thinking, and not through any magic of the wizard, that Dorothy and her companions, as well as everyone else in Oz, got what they wanted. End quote. It would become a popular Hollywood theme. Dumbo's magic feather, Pollyanna's irrepressible positive thinking, the music man's think system for making beautiful music, the unsinkable Molly Brown. Thinking positively was not just the stuff of children's fantasies, but was deeply ingrained in the American psyche. I have learned, said Henry David Thoreau, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. As a quote from Henry David Thoreau. William James, another 19th century American philosopher, said, quote, the greatest discovery of my generation is that a human being can alter his life by altering his attitudes of mind. End quote. Franklin Roosevelt broadcast this upbeat message in his Depression-era fireside chats, in which he entered people's homes through that exciting new medium, the radio, and galvanized the country with encouraging words. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, he said in 1933, when the enemy was poverty and unemployment. Andrew Carnegie, one of the multimillionaire robber barons, was another firm believer in achievement through positive thinking. It is the mind that makes the body rich, he maintained. Believing that financial success could be reduced to a simple formula, he commissioned a newspaper reporter named Napoleon Hill to interview over 500 millionaires to discover the common threads of their success. Hill then memorialized the results in his best-selling book, Think and Grow Rich. Thinking positively was a trait of the robber barons themselves, who for all their mischief were a characteristically American phenomenon. They thought big. If there was a criminal element to their thinking, it was a crime the law had not yet codified. The Wild West, the Gold Rush, the Gilded Age, the Roaring Twenties, all were part of the wild and reckless youth of the nation. The robber barons were a product of the American capitalist spirit, the spirit of believing in what you want and making it happen. An aspect of a free market is the freedom to steal, which is why economics must be tempered with the Constitution and the law. That was the fatal flaw in the laissez-faire free market economics of the 19th century. It allowed opportunists to infiltrate and monopolize industry. America's founding fathers saw the necessity of designing a government that would protect the inalienable rights of the people from the power grabs of the unscrupulous. Today, we generally think we want less government, not more, but our forebears had a different view of the function of government. This is a critical point. A different view of the function of government. The Declaration of Independence declared, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." End quote. The capitalist spirit of achieving one's dreams needed to operate within an infrastructure that ensured and supported a fair race. Naming the villains and locking them up could help temporarily, but to create a millennial utopia, the legal edifice itself had to be secured. When Frank Baum wrote his famous fairy tale at the turn of the 20th century, and of course that's The Wizard of Oz, the notion that a life of scarcity could be transformed in an instant into one of universal abundance did not seem entirely far-fetched. It was an era of miracles, when scientists were bringing electricity, mechanized transportation, and the promise of free energy to America. Explosive technological advances evoked visions of a utopian future filled with modern transportation and communication facilities, along with jobs, housing, and food for all. Catapulting the country into universal abundance was possible, but it did not happen. Instead, a darker form of witchcraft enthralled the country. By the time The Wizard of Oz was made into a musical in the 1930s, the economy had again fallen into a major depression. Yip Harburg, who wrote the lyrics to Somewhere Over the Rainbow, had a long list of hit songs, including Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Harburg was not actually a member of the Communist Party, but he was a staunch advocate of a variety of left-leaning causes. His Hollywood career came to a halt when he was blacklisted in the 1950s, another visionary fallen to an agenda of fear and control. By the end of the 20th century, however, science had again reached a stage of development where abundance for all seemed within reach. Buckminster Fuller said in 1980, quote, "We are blessed with technology that would be indescribable to our forefathers. We have the wherewithal, the know-it-all to feed everybody, clothe everybody, and give every human on earth a chance. We know now what we could never have known before, that we now have the option for all humanity to make it successfully on this planet in this lifetime. Whether it is to be utopia or oblivion will be a touch-and-go relay race right to the final moment." Close quote. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to utopia or oblivion. The race between utopia and oblivion reflects two different visions of reality. One sees a world capable of providing for all. The other sees a world that is too small for its inhabitants, requiring the annihilation of large segments of the population if the rest are to survive. The prevailing scarcity mentality focuses on shortages of oil, water, and food. But the real shortage, as Benjamin Franklin explained to his English listeners in the 18th century, is in the medium of exchange. If sufficient money could be made available to develop alternative sources of energy, alternative means of extracting water from the environment, and more efficient ways of growing food, there could be abundance for all. The notion that the government could simply print the money it needs is considered unrealistically utopian and inflationary, yet banks create money all the time. The chief reason the U.S. government can't do it is that a private banking cartel already has a monopoly on the practice. And this is really the critical point of all of the shows that we have done. The U.S. government can't create the money because a private banking cartel already has a monopoly on that practice. Growth in the M3 is no longer officially being reported, but by 2007, reliable private sources put it at 11% per year. That meant that over $1 trillion were being added to the economy annually. Where did this new money come from? It couldn't have come from new infusions of gold, since the country went off the gold standard in 1933. All of this additional money must have been created by banks as loans. As soon as the loans are paid off, the money has to be borrowed all over again just to keep money in the system. And it is here that we find the real cause of global scarcity. Somebody is paying interest on most of the money in the world all of the time. A dollar accruing interest at 5% compounded annually becomes $2 in about 14 years. At that rate, banks siphon off as much money in interest every 14 years as there was in the entire world 14 years earlier. That explains why M3 has increased by 100% or more every 14 years since the Federal Reserve first started tracking it in 1959. So just a footnote on this point about the banks siphoning off as much money in interest every 14 years as there was in the entire world 14 years earlier. Now this assumes that the debt is not paid but just keeps compounding. But in the system as a whole, that would be true. When old loans get paid off, debt money is extinguished, so new loans must continually be taken out just to keep the money supply at its current level. And since banks create the principal but not the interest necessary to pay off their loans, someone somewhere has to continually be taking out new loans to create the money to cover the interest due on this collective debt. Interest then continually accrues on these new loans, compounding the interest due on the whole. Debunkers of this debt virus theory argue that bankers spend the money they receive on labor and goods, which trickles down so that the borrowers can repay their loans. That might be true if the banks were publicly owned and were mandated to return their profits to the community, but it is not how the private banking system actually works. Bankers spend little of their profits hiring the debtor class or buying their products. They save the excess and invest it, which generally means more interest-bearing debt. Net bank profits become capital, which under the Basel I capital adequacy rule can be fanned into 12 times the sum or more in new loans, all at compound interest, feeding the debt virus. But back to the principal point. M3 has increased by 100% or more every 14 years since the Federal Reserve first started tracking it in 1959. According to the Fed's own table, the M3 money stock, M3 was about $300 billion in 1959. In 1973, 14 years later, it had grown to $900 billion. In 1987, 14 years after that, it was $3,500 billion. And in 2001, 14 years after that, it was $7,200 billion. To meet the huge interest burden required to service all this money built on debt, the money supply must continually expand, and for that to happen, borrowers must continually go deeper into debt, merchants must continually raise their prices, and the odd men out in the banker's game of musical chairs must continue to lose their property to the banks. Wars, competition, and strife are the inevitable results of this scarcity-driven system. Well, the obvious solution is to eliminate the parasitic banking scheme that is feeding on the world's prosperity. But how? The witches of Wall Street are not likely to release their vice-like grip without some sort of revolution, and a violent revolution would probably fail because the world's most feared military machine is already in the hands of the money cartel. Violent revolution would just furnish them with an excuse to test their equipment. The first American Revolution was fought before tasers, lasers, tear gas, armored tanks, and depleted uranium weapons. Fortunately or unfortunately, in the eye of today's economic cyclone, we may have to do no more than watch and wait as the global pyramid scheme collapses of its own weight. In the end, what is likely to bring the house of cards down is that the robber barons have lost control of the propaganda machine. Their intellectual foe is the internet, that last bastion of free speech, where even the common blogger can find a voice. As President John Adams is quoted as saying of the revolution of his day, "The revolution was effected before the war commenced. The revolution was in the hearts and minds of the people. This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution." End quote. Today, the corporate media are gradually losing control of public opinion. But the money machine remains shrouded in mystery, largely because the subject is so complex and forbidding. Richard Russell is a respected financial analyst who has been publishing the Dow Theory Letter for over half a century. He observes, quote, "The creation of money is a total mystery to probably 99% of the U.S. population, and that most definitely includes the Congress and the Senate. The takeover of U.S. money creation by the Fed is one of the most mysterious and ominous acts in U.S. history. The legality of the Federal Reserve has never been tried before the U.S. Supreme Court." End quote. We the people could try bringing suit before the Supreme Court, but the courts, like the major media, are now largely under the spell of the financial corporate cartel. There are honest and committed judges, congresspersons, and reporters who could be approached, but to make a real impact will take a vigorous movement from an awakened and aroused populace ready to be heard and make a difference, a popular force too strong to be ignored. When a certain critical mass of people has awakened, the curtain can be thrown aside and the wizard's hand can be exposed. But before we can build a movement, we need to be ready with an action plan, an arc that will keep us afloat when the flood hits. What sort of arc might that be? We'll begin by looking at a number of alternative models that have been developed around the world in the upcoming shows. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. Speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.